This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, police seize millions of dollars of hard drugs at Tonga's National Reserve Bank. Micronesian countries call out the United States over delays in funding, and it's election fever in Solomon Islands as political parties launch their manifestos, with one party in particular looking north towards China. We'll have more on those stories coming up. But first, a motion of no confidence against Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister has hit a snag with a typo delaying its progress in Parliament. It was just part of the drama playing out in the PNG capital, Port Moresby, where opposition MPs are trying to oust Prime Minister James Marape. At the front of their campaign is former government MP Alan Bird, who's also the governor of East Sepik Province. But the man picked to challenge Mr. Marape for the top job said he was completely caught off guard when he was chosen.
I had no idea I would be a nominee for Prime Minister, to be honest with you, and I was quite unprepared. I rolled up to the meeting, not dressed for the occasion, very casual. And when the discussion came up, I actually, well, first of all, I didn't want to be a nominee, but then given some of the pleadings from some of the MPs, I conceded. But even more so, I actually asked them if we could delay it for a week or a month or something to sort of allow for more government MPs to come along and other senior leaders could throw their hat in the ring. But some of our senior leaders, including the Honorable Peter O'Neill, former Prime Minister, and particularly, say, Pukatemu, also another senior MP and former Deputy Prime Minister, said, look, you know, our people want to see us doing something and they want us to demonstrate that we are serious about changing the government and we need to put forward a credible candidate. And we need to take that decision now.
The opposition has around 23 MPs. You'll need at least double that number to unseat the current Prime Minister.
Look, there's a lot of dissatisfied government MPs. Obviously, our kind of politics is such that a lot of MPs are promised a lot of things by the government. And, you know, you've seen some of the allegations around the fundraising activities of the government. So obviously they've got a pretty big war chest, which, you know, compared to us, we don't have one. So we're standing on principle here. But I mean, there's another pressure as well. And that pressure is going to come from the people of Papua New Guinea who are battling cost of living pressures, increasing law and order issues, significant unemployment. So these are the sorts of pressures that I think are going to be brought to members of parliament over the next week or so. And we're having active discussions with a lot of government MPs. And it's up to them to, I guess, search their conscience. And I guess everyone has to answer the question of, look, am I happy coming to Waigani and begging for funds to take back and try and help my people? Or do we want a better system that doesn't have members of parliament come to Waigani crawling on their hands and knees looking for funds, which is something we've all been doing for more than 30 years. And I guess that's what I'm proposing, to overhaul the entire system and to move us quickly towards a federal type system that Australia has. So that's what I've been advocating for a while. And so it's up to them to decide whether they all want a master in Waigani or whether the entire country wants to be free to develop and move in a new direction.
Is PNG ready for change? And how would you run PNG differently if you are successful?
You just have to look at the social commentary after the announcement was made. I mean, we have a very smart young MP by the name of Honorable Keith Idugu, who's a first-termer. He did a post online about the nomination, and within 20 minutes, he had 300 responses and, you know, like something like 35 shares. And he showed it to me and he said, bro, look at this. This is how Papua New Guinea is responding. He says, I never get more than 100 likes on my posts and not in 20 minutes. And that's one indicator that I guess that the country wants change. What I would do, look, as I said, the Australian model is there. I think we adopted that model post independence, and then we kind of changed again in 1995. We currently have a centralized model of government where all power is centralized in Wegani, which gives the prime minister considerable power because he can then, any prime minister can use the funds concentrated in Wegani to basically hold on to power. My argument has been for a number of years that power needs to be shared and that every province has a unique identity, unique challenges, and they need to be given the freedom to resolve their challenges. And they can't be brought to Port Moresby and, you know, all of this funding weaponized to keep a single person in power. I mean, we can still have a prime minister in Port Moresby dealing with national and international issues, but the solution to things like law and order, healthcare, education, infrastructure access, opportunity creation for our people would be better achieved if we changed the way intergovernment financing works. I've been a governor for 6 years now, and I'm acutely aware of the problems. I did some work for a former Minister for Planning, the Honorable Charles Abel, in that capacity almost 10 years ago now. And we proposed the adoption of a model similar to Australian, and it hasn't been done. So I'm pretty convinced currently less 15% of Papua New Guinea's funding goes to the provinces, and we have 22 provinces. The majority of the funding is kept in Wegani, 85% of it. And I'm proposing that a larger percentage of the funding gets pushed down to the provinces.
The governor of East Sepik Province in Papua New Guinea, Alan Bird, another man who'll be challenging James Marape for the top post when that motion of no confidence gets voted in Parliament. And Governor Bird was speaking there to the ABC's Agnes Tupou. A long-standing alliance between the United States and the Pacific nations of Palau, Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia is being tested. Washington's already 5 months late in delivering $1.6 billion in grants agreed upon in new compacts that was signed off last year. So while the U.S. continues to maintain a military presence in Micronesia, the payoff is still being tied up in red tape. As Kyle Evans reports, one former senior government figure in the North Pacific says the Micronesian leaders are fielding offers of financial support from elsewhere.
The Compact of Free Associations Pact has long been a win-win for the US and the Micronesian states of Palau, Marshall Islands, and FSM. It has provided billions of dollars in grants to Micronesia, and in return gives the US military a prime strategic foothold in the Pacific. But now, at a time of increased competition between the US and China in the region, the funds are locked behind bureaucratic tape. And one former Marshallese leader worries about what it all means.
Well, I can say unequivocally that even if the compact funding did go through, there'd still be a threat. So I think there's a lot to lose here for the United States. And the idea that the politics as they are in the US right now are just so unpredictable, and they're so inefficient now at producing any kind of legislation. I just really fear for this area of the world when, you see these kind of delays, and it's just pretty upsetting for a lot of people here.
Jack Needenthal is the former Marshall Islands Health Secretary. He says his country is already being forced to survive on its own resources, and the delay of funding is placing pressure on government services. But that's not all. He says it could shake the diplomatic balance of the region also.
And when you have what's been going on in this region with China, where they've just, Nauru just went over to the Chinese and used to be ally and used to be recognizing Taiwan, the feel for Taiwan is very strong here in the Marshall Islands. We're very strong allies of Taiwan, but that could change. It's not like you have to convince all 42,000 people here not to make that kind of change. All you need to really do is convince 17 people, because there's 33 people in the parliament, and that's a little bit scary to some of us.
Needenthal says that process may have already started.
I think there are already Micronesians who are listening, and I think the U.S. has to take this a lot more seriously than they are.
Palau's president, Seranga Whips Jr., highlighted similar concerns on Monday. While he told Pacific Beat his administration would never switch diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China, the risk was there if another leader were to be elected.
Just in the last election, when I was running, there was at least two of the four candidates that were campaigning on the fact that we should reevaluate our relationship with Taiwan and look at other economic opportunities. The majority of the Palauan people voiced their opinion in the last election. I believe that's where Palau stands. But of course, when you're faced with economic challenges that you run out of options, that you always run those risks.
Despite the dire warnings, experts aren't optimistic the US will be able to push the legislation through soon. Graham Smith from the Australian National University's Department of Pacific Affairs says there's simply too much dysfunction within its Congress.
It's ironic because if you held up both the Republicans and the Democrats and said, you know, what do you think about this? They would all say, oh, yes, you know, this ought to be passed and we should renew these agreements. And yet, they didn't manage to attach it to the defence bill. They didn't even bother trying to attach it to the immigration bill, which is going to fail anyway. So, it's really about congressional dysfunction, which, depending on how the next elections go, is only going to get worse.
However, Smith says there's limitations on what China can offer Micronesian states. Under current deals with the US, Micronesian citizens get various privileges in relation to access and migration to the US. He says any win the Chinese could score is by having the Compact Association agreements torn up. He says that alone should be a huge incentive to ensure US Congress actions the Compact Association funding. And soon.
Anything is possible because, you know, it is in the US interest to maintain exclusive access to the maritime waters in this region. But it's equally in China's interest to at least muddy the waters and make it less clear that the US has the right to operate in these waters. And if it can do so relatively cheaply, then it will certainly do so. And the reason they're crucial, it's Taiwan. So if China does, under Xi Jinping, follow through and try to take Taiwan by force, then the most likely scenario is that were the US to come to Taiwan's aid, which would depend who is in the White House, they would have to sail through the Northern Pacific to do so. And so that's why those waters are so crucial. It's really, in the end, not so much about Taiwan recognition, but about the physical defence of Taiwan.
That was Graham Smith, Associate Professor and Senior Fellow in the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University, ending that report from Kyle Evans. Opposition politicians in Solomon Islands are vowing to make public or even scrap a security pact with China if they manage to oust Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare when the country goes to the polls in April. Meanwhile, Mr. Sogavare has unveiled the political platform for his own political party, vowing to further consolidate ties with Beijing under a look north foreign policy. Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jajets with more.
In Solomon Islands, campaign rallies echo with song and with prayer, with even political manifestos receiving a blessing.
We thank you for our many blessings. We thank you for the words, the message that
But opposition figure Matthew Wale is striking a more combative tone.
We have an economy where Solomon Islanders are increasingly marginalized. We have an economy that takes the natural resources from Solomon Islanders to make foreigners rich.
Mr. Wale and his coalition partners are trying to remove Manasseh Sogavare, the country's dominant political figure. Mr. Sogavare has forged close ties with China, signing a deeply contentious security pact with Beijing, which has alarmed Australia. But Mr. Wale and his partners say Mr. Sogavare has neglected critical health and education services while allowing foreign logging companies to keep on plundering forests in Solomon Islands.
We have a government that is not controlled by Solomon Islanders. It is a government made up of Solomon Islanders, all right, but it is not controlled by Solomon Islanders. A government that receives money to make sure that the status quo continues.
Manasseh Sogavare sees it differently. He's spruiking the massive investments China's made into Solomon Islands, including mobile towers, new roads, and a huge stadium for last year's Pacific Games.
Despite the challenges by the COVID-19 pandemic and the violent campaigns that led to the carnage in Honiara,
our party still delivered many transformative outcomes.
Mr. Wale has accused Mr. Sogavare of kissing China's feet and is promising to make the contentious security pact with China public.
We need to be talking on our protecting and advancing our own national interests, not kowtowing and not bowing down like beggars with no respect.
But unlike some other opposition figures, he's not committing to dumping the pact. And in the end, his position may not matter much. While politics in Solomon Islands is famously quicksilver, Dr. Graham Smith from the Australian National University says Mr. Sogavare could well secure an unprecedented second consecutive term.
As far as I'm aware, he would be the first man to manage that in the Solomon Islands, because these coalitions are immensely unpredictable and shifting. It is possible, if not likely, that he will be the first to do so, because he has a war chest behind him that I think his predecessors did not have.
A milestone which would be very unlikely to be celebrated in Canberra.
The ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jajets, with that report. Businesses affected by the recent riots in Papua New Guinea's capital, Port Moresby, say they urgently need the government to follow through on its promise of assistance. It's just been over a month since large mobs of people ran amok on the streets, looting and burning shops at will after police walked off the job over a pay dispute. As Liam Fox reports, affected businesses have been assured of help, but just how much is being offered is still yet to be decided.
The riots and looting could not have come at a worse time for Bahori Joku.
I have breast cancer. I'm a cancer survivor. I just had an operation in November last year, and I was hoping to go to Australia to have another scan, which is not available in Port Moresby. And all of this has thrown everything into turmoil for me.
Now she has no income to pay for medical treatment overseas after two buildings in the suburb of Sabama, one she owns and rents, the other she part-owns that housed a supermarket, were looted and burned in last month's riots. On that day, January 10, Ms. Joku watched on helplessly from her house nearby as people she knew joined in the senseless destruction of her livelihood.
It seemed that I was the only one trained for the looting not to take place, and the entire community came out and looted. My family and I were totally outnumbered. We couldn't stop anything. And now, after everything's gone down and in ashes, and I see the community really in shock.
She's surviving with help from her family, but it's not enough to get her back up on her feet.
Since the looting, there was panic that there'd be no food, you know, coming around to Moresby and all that. So I kind of depleted my savings, and I have children who are supporting me, but it's really nothing compared to what I was earning from rent from the buildings.
In the days after the riots, the Prime Minister, James Marape, promised the government would help affected businesses. Ms. Joku is desperately waiting for that help to arrive.
We've been told that police or criminal investigators would come around. I've seen police vehicles come around, including today, but no one has come and talked to me. So basically there's no response at all from the government for assistance.
There's been a lot of conversation. There's been a lot of discussions. There's been a lot of exchange of information since the 10th of January. What we need now is addition.
Ian Tarutia is the president of the PNG Chamber of Commerce and Industry. In a joint submission to government, the chamber and other business representative groups have put the damage bill at around 800 million kina. That's around 320 million Australian dollars. He says they're collectively asking for just under half of that to be released in cash payments immediately to affected businesses to keep them afloat while they rebuild.
To help businesses start the process of rebuild, physical property, purchase of stock, the keeping of staff who do not have jobs at the moment because their shops are burned.
It's a lot of money to hand out in cash, and in a country where corruption is widespread, such a scheme would be a ripe target for fraudsters. Mr. Tarutia says the business groups are proposing a public-private partnership to oversee relief payments.
There's got to be a validation and a vetting process. So, you know, some of the things that we want to look at is, you know, are they tax compliant, for example? Superannuation and compliance is also going to be looked at.
But back in Sabama, Bahori Joku is worried that small businesses like hers will miss out. She can't even get insurance because she's been unable to secure titles for the land on which her buildings were located.
The government's focus on compensation is with the big guys like Brian Bell, City Pharmacy, Steamships, group of companies. No one's looking at the Asians or myself. We have to run around and look for assistance that's available or they say is available.
Pacific Beat has sought comment from the city's governor, Powers Parkop.
Tonga's top cop says the discovery of nearly 10 kilograms of methamphetamines in an office of the National Reserve Bank is the result of a renewed crackdown on hard drugs in the kingdom. Two people, a brother and sister, have been arrested. One was a senior official at the bank, and police found another 5 kilograms of the drug. And police found another 5 kilograms of the drug at one of their houses. Police Commissioner Shane McLennan says it's a big haul for such a small country.
Our Drug Enforcement Task Force here in Tonga Police and also our drug squad that's located within our central police district at Central Station here in Nuku'alofa, the capital, have been very active, particularly the last 12 months where we've re-energised our efforts, and that's resulted in multiple arrests at of street level dealing, and Operation Feki is just one of the many operations that we've run through the drug squad over the last 12 months. So on the weekend was just the very the beginning, if you like, of that particular operation.
The reports have said one of the suspects is a bank official, but the National Reserve Bank of Tonga has been implicated in this as well. So I'm just wondering, because drugs were found there, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. One of our offenders is a senior member of the National Reserve Bank here in Tonga, and a little over 5 kilos was seized on late on Saturday night from the family home. On Sunday, with the cooperation, can I say, of the governor of the Reserve Bank, we gained access to the person's office. And that's where we located another 9.9 kilos in his office. So that certainly is concerning that we have such a respected member of the community occupying a senior level of employment at our National Reserve Bank. That's certainly concerning. But we're very grateful that we've up until this point and obviously hopeful there will be ongoing cooperation from Reserve Bank officials.
There have been words. Tonga has a drug crisis, and it doesn't seem or even appear to be slowing down, judging by the recent cases. How else are the police tackling this issue?
Multiple ways, Aggie, and it all starts, as I mentioned, with community cooperation. We certainly have a drug problem here in Tonga. You know, there's not many communities around that could say that they don't have a drug problem, to be honest. I don't use the term a crisis. I think that's not what we have here, but we certainly have a drug problem, and we are addressing that. And the government of Tonga is very supportive. The Prime Minister chairs the Illicit Drugs Response Fund, and there's a committee process within that, and the government's been very generous over the last couple of years with allocating some sizable money, and I'm talking in the millions of pānga each year towards that drug fund. And what it does is it allows all ministries within Tonga, but also NGOs and others to apply for specific funds to address different parts of the drug problem. So that's going very well, and we're very grateful to the Prime Minister and the government for that.
Tonga's Police Commissioner Shane McLennan speaking there to the ABC's Agnes Tupou. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the region. Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.